Okay, I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. And we are on Thursday, June 23rd, 2016. Real pleasure to have you all here. We have a number of people on the phone, but let's go around the room first and see who's here in person. I'm Michael Dembro, the task force chair. I represent Northeast and Southeast Portland in the Oregon Senate. And to my left,
I'm Lou Frederick, a state representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland.
Paul Solomon, I'm the executive director of Sponsors in Lane County, a reentry organization, and the chair of Lane County's Public Safety Coordinating Council.
Great.
Jim Booker, the federal programs manager for the Oregon Employment Department.
I'm Cheyenne Rawson, part of the nonpartisan committee services staff here, and taking Zoe's place today.
And then we have some guests in the room, and we'll start with Ryan.
Ryan Fisher, I represent the Oregon Housing Authority, statewide association of public housing authorities.
I'm Josh Cook, I'm the deputy administrator for Oregon Corrections Enterprises, and I'm sitting in for Ken Jeske today.
I'm Dan Calvin, I'm project manager for the Marion County Reentry Initiative.
Okay, great. Yes.
I'm Laura Johnson. I work for Sponsors in Lane County, where I direct the women's program.
Great. Welcome.
Jim Rollins, Director of Admissions at the University of Oregon.
Roger Thompson, Vice President for Enrollment at the University of Oregon.
Matt Lynn, Director of State Relations for the University of Oregon.
I'm Amy Joyce from ODOT Government Relations, here today for DMV.
Great. And Janet, who are you?
I am Janet Carlson, Commissioner from Marion County. Happy to be here.
Great. Good. And?
Good afternoon, Senator. Andrea Fogg, Legislative and Public Affairs for the Oregon Employment Department.
Okay. We have some people on the phone. So who is on the phone?
I am. I don't know who wants to go first, but this is Jeremy Nichols from Mercy Corps Northwest. Representing the housing advocate position.
Okay, great. Jeremy.
Deborah Enzi with Multifamily Northwest, executive director. Our members own and manage over 175,000 units in the state.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Is Eddie Alves. I'm the vice president of academic affairs at Treasure Valley Community College. I represent the education.
Okay, welcome. Good to have you, Eddie. Anyone else on the phone?
Yes, Truls Neal, Deputy Director, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, also representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors.
Okay, great.
And this is Michael Haynes Garcia at the University of Oregon and the Department of Ethnic Studies.
Okay, welcome.
And this is Kim Travis with Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Okay, great, Kim. Anyone else on the phone? Okay. Members, be sure to speak up if you have a question. Remind me that you're there. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Before we start the actual business of the committee, I just want to do a couple of housekeeping things. First of all, Deborah Imsi has introduced herself as being on the phone, but as the chair, I really want to extend a welcome to Deborah as a member of this task force. Between the last meeting and this meeting, we discovered that she should have been part of this task force all along, but somehow, I don't know what happened, but the formal invitation never went out or was never accepted or whatever, but I really apologize for that, Deborah, and it's really great to have you as part of this group.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm just glad to be part of the group and hope to be able to contribute.
Okay, great. And so that's the good news. The not so good news is that Jeremy Nichols is going to have to leave us I guess next month, is that right? Jeremy, why don't you speak for yourself?
Will be my last month attending the meeting.
Okay. So we don't usually let people off of our task forces, but Jeremy seems to have a decent reason for it.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something?
My girlfriend got into grad school in Chicago, so unfortunately we are moving out of the great state of Oregon to Illinois. So hopefully they continue this good work there. But it's been a real honor to be on the task force, and I've learned a lot. You know, I think we're on the cusp of achieving something really great.
Yeah, that's great. Jeremy, we really appreciate your presence. You've added a lot. And it'll be hard to find somebody to take your place, but we will try to find someone who can represent the, you know, the housing advocate, someone who does the kind of work that you do and helping with reentry housing for ex-offenders. Anyway, glad to have you with us today. We will be spending a fair amount of time today on housing, so it's great that you're still with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Okay, so let's start off with our first item, and that has to do with college applications and access to higher education for ex-offenders. And we have some friends from the University of Oregon. Why don't you come on up? Yeah. And I'll just give you a little background to this. I'm kind of a higher ed wonky person, and so I read different magazines, including an online higher ed magazine called Inside Higher Education. And there was an item in there a couple of months ago that talked about universities and colleges across the country, including questions about people's offense records on the college application. And I hadn't been aware of that as a practice, and so I reached out to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to find out if that was, in fact, a practice here in Oregon. And they reached out to the member institutions heard back from, I think, most of them, apparently it's not a question that's a part of the community college process, but it is to some extent at the university level, and that the University of Oregon has recently instituted this practice. And so, you know, I've been in conversation with the University of Oregon to see what motivated it, how it works, and you know, felt that that was, you know, it was an issue that we should talk about as a task force, and to hear just again what the reasons are and what its intent is and how it's actually working. So that's kind of a softball lob to you guys to explain the program, please.
Yeah. Sure. Well, thank you, Senator, for inviting us, and also Representative Frederick. I think you two are co-chairing this task force, if I've got that right. Maybe not. But anyway, it's nice to see you two, as well as the rest of the task force. So a little bit of a background on what we're doing at the University of Oregon, and then we'll walk you through some of the results of what's occurred. So for us at the University of Oregon, it was a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, we formed a task force, which I asked Jim Rollins to chair as the head of admissions. The task force included folks from around the university, faculty, staff, students, many people on campus. Because one of the things that we noticed was we had hundreds, if not close to 1,000 institutions across the country that were asking about criminal background or student discipline conduct kinds of issues. This was something that was not a question that we asked on our campus at the time, but something that we were interested in pursuing or at least investigating, researching whether it was something we should do. So we had a broad-based task force that came together to look at it, particularly in light of some things that were happening in the Pac-12, our athletic conference, where the vast majority of institutions were already asking this kind of question. In the Pac-12 conference, it related primarily to transfer students coming at different points in time. So anyway, in looking at our in getting the task force together, we had broad-based representation, and the consideration was, should we be asking a question about someone's criminal history, if there is one, or student disciplinary, student conduct kinds of issues. One of the things that we shared throughout the time on campus, and it's one of the things I'm very proud of, in my tenure, I just started my seventh year at the University of Oregon, when it comes to domestic minority students enrolling, so not counting international students, we have more than doubled the number since I arrived. We're proud that this last year's freshman class had 28% of our students represented what we would be what we would consider traditionally domestic minority students, and an additional 9% that came internationally. So we have made the University of Oregon more diverse than the state in which we reside, and that has been intentional, and we've done that through work with many folks, including Representative Frederick, who's been in on many of these discussions that we started 5 or 6 years ago. So one of my primary concerns was, with all the momentum that we've had in making our campus more diverse, we certainly didn't want to do anything that would slow that momentum or in any way be detrimental to what we were trying to do. I'm going to let Jim walk through the process that we established, but our goals were to do something that was, well, really reasonable. We want to look for reasons to say yes to students, and as he walks you through the process, you'll see that that's exactly what we're doing. We wanted to use best practices from across the country. We did not want to be in a situation similar to some of the schools that were cited in the Inside Higher Education article, where if you simply check a box, you're denied admission. That's not at all what we're doing. And we wanted to be as transparent as we could be so that students, families, parents would understand what it is we are doing. And so before Jim walks you through the process, let me just simply reassure you, we are not in a sort of ban the box type situation that you see in housing or employment in many places. That's not what the University of Oregon is doing. And I think you'll see that as we give you some insight as to how our process works. So Jim, if you'd kind of walk folks through how we proceed, I think that would be helpful.
Absolutely. And before I do that, I do want to throw out a few additional things kind of for background, because I think it does tie very much to how we wanted to construct this process at the University of Oregon. For one, as Roger mentioned, there are hundreds of colleges around the country who not only ask questions like this, but have been doing so for quite some time. And as much as we'd love to say we learned best practices from them, we also learned some of the best what not to do things. And I would never want to throw my colleagues who are doing this work as well as they can at other institutions under the bus by saying this, but certainly we were able to watch some of the things that were of greatest concern and watch out for them. To be clear, this is our first year doing this process, and so we were very deliberative with the task force Roger describes, making sure that as we moved towards this year, we always update our application in the summer, for example, that we really thought through some of the things about what were some of the best ways we could skip past the difficult first efforts and really launch into a process that really took care of things well. We are following a practice of most other institutions who do any of this around the country to ask students about both their student conduct in the context of things that have happened at their high school or at their colleges they have attended, and also asking about any criminal background record that would be with or without a parallel in the school setting. That is a typical pairing of questions that most institutions ask, including the nearly 600 who are members of the Common Application Group. We're mainly talking about public institutions in Oregon, Oregon today, but I'll remind you there are several private institutions here in Oregon that are Common App members and have therefore had these questions in place for quite some time. The Common App added these questions in 07 and with a great deal of care made some decisions, for example, to encourage all of their members not to ask about things that were currently under adjudication or otherwise not yet resolved, asking students to be able to feel free to share things in a way that not only said yes or no to any of the do you have these in your past, but giving them a place right up front to explain what was going on, rather than, as Roger mentioned, take on the unfortunate approach of saying, if you've done any of this, we're not going to take you, and making the student go through hoop after hoop to try to at least get an explanation out there. The one thing we did that was above and beyond what most institutions, and really spoke to some of the many things that our task force thought about, was to decide to add a third question that you could really think of as a subset of the criminal background question. But it was to specifically ask students to talk about any issues related to stalking or restraining orders. Part of that's on the advice of some of our peers around the country who noted that some situations like that did not necessarily involve a conviction, but something that may still be of interest to us. And so we decided to particularly call attention to that. So we actually ask a third question at the University of Oregon, which is a little out of the ordinary. We certainly were talking about this in a way that wasn't just about offenses that may have to do with sexual assault or those kinds of things, but it certainly would find its way to the top of most lists we would make of things we were most concerned about and what was most fresh on our minds in terms of the things we were trying to address. We also thought about the fact that even though to ask about student conduct within a school and criminal conduct outside a school are different in some ways, what they aren't mutually exclusive with is the nature of actions that could have taken place in either environment. So it's very much in keeping with other institutions that we felt would be only looking at half the picture, proverbially with one hand over one of our eyes, to only look at just the criminal side or just the student conduct side of this, because oftentimes students' backgrounds involve things that could go either of those ways, depending on the where, not just the when. What we wound up with was a process that included a three-tier review process, and we put it in place this year. This question was asked of all roughly 30,000 applications for undergraduate degree-seeking admission at the University of Oregon. Those 30,000 applicants almost all apply online, and the process we set in place was very much designed to assume that while we felt the need to see this information and be able to consider it just to see if there was any potential safety risk on the campus, that we already knew right up front from what our peers told us and what we expected to see and from what we see happening to students around the country, that in most of these cases we weren't going to find it enough of a difficulty that we would keep the student out based on it. We wanted to protect that student's confidentiality, always with the assumption that we were literally going to clear most of the applicants that applied. Because of that, we took an extraordinary measure that most other institutions don't take, and we made it so that when the student submits this application, the yes answers themselves, not to mention the explanation, do not even appear on the application document that's created within the university or that most of my staff in the admissions office can see.
One quick thing I want to interject there. That was critical, we felt, because we did not want a student who might have said yes or answered affirmatively to a question to be able to be identified by their faculty member later during the time that they enrolled at the University of Oregon. So it was very important for us that a limited number of people see any, be aware of any applicant that answered affirmatively to any of the questions. We did not want to create a situation for the student later in their classes. Sorry.
That's all right. So I'm one of those five people. Another one is the associate director of my staff, who I had to have create this technology for us. The third person within my office who can see it is the first person who does our initial round of screening for the small number of students that do answer yes. The other two people are the director of student conduct for the university and our university registrar. That's it. And so what we're able to do with this, I, as much as I appreciate what Roger points out, I'd even go back earlier in the process. We don't even want the rest of the admissions office to see this. And one of the things we feel we can agree with on some of the concerns about this practice around the country is that there are some schools that use this information not only to determine the safety issues surrounding a student's entry onto a campus, but in a competitive and comparative sense that starts to come down to what some might call simply a highly competitive admissions environment, or the idea of considering character and making an admissions decision. I don't think it's coincidental that in some of the national critiques that have happened about this, by the way. A lot of that has been focused on one or two institutions that turn away 90% of their applicants, and they are looking for countless ways to say no to a lot of people, whereas we are a public institution that is thrilled to say yes as often as we can. I would also point out that one of the other main institutions or systems that's been critiqued for this process is a 64-campus statewide system in which students are only given the chance to answer yes or no to an entire system of campuses, no explanation given the opportunity to give. And then if that gets passed along to, say, five of those campuses that that student is interested in, they must answer the question five different times, potentially five slightly different or largely different ways to five different committees on five different timelines. It's no wonder that in those kinds of environments, both that students are chilled or given disincentives to think that they are welcome at that institution, as well as the fact that large numbers of people, even just within the admissions office, know and can continue to know this information and the details surrounding it past the time that a determination of safety has been made. These are some of the very important things we knew we needed to guard against, and we're very proud with the way we've done this, such that I hope other institutions around the country are going to follow our quick lead.
One point on that, just as background, you referenced the Inside Higher Education article, and that article cites a number of studies that were done around the 64-campus system in New York and their process and some of the inherent problems in that process, which we intentionally avoided replicating.
What we've built, again, is an assumption that most of these students are going to be fine. Once we see the details, we can be done with it quickly and we move on. The third member of my admissions staff, who I had mentioned, who screens these in the first round, is only given the ability to clear students, not to deny them. And she is working from a very carefully constructed kind of score sheet, if you will, that was developed using a combination of the Federal Clery Act guidelines for campus safety, as well as our own university student conduct guidelines for what we consider behavior of concern. Basically, what she was trained to do was to look at all the answers students could have provided, categorize what she saw, and if anything rose to the level that it needed more expert looks and expert discussions, she would forward those along to our student conduct office for another look.
Jim, could you say something about the Clery Act?
Sure.
And what it involves.
Just some very basic things, and the act owes its name to a student who had horrible crimes committed against her, and her family passed, you know, worked with the legislature in Congress on this after her death. It's meant to really assure that college campuses are required to disclose regularly and disclose consistently a particular range of crimes and offenses that take place on their campus each year. And so it's a very standard way of defining categories of what the public needs to know. And so
federally.
Is that sufficient for right now? Okay.
Federal law.
It's a federal law. So our staff member, unless it rose to kind of that higher level alarm bells going off thing, was clearing the vast majority of these applicants this year and in pretty short order. While there's been some advice that students should have this review done later in the process, that's largely born out of a concern that, again, we've avoided in certain other ways. I can see very much the concern that we wouldn't want this to stop a student right off the bat and it work against them the rest of the process. But because we've insulated this information from the rest of the process, our goal has been instead to make this go by so quickly that the vast majority of our applicants would never even experience a slowdown in what we otherwise want to be a very quick, very positive experience applying to the university. That first round clearance could be done single-handedly by this person. If it was not something that passed muster, it would go on to our student conduct office for a second round review. He and perhaps one of his assistant directors, who he's added this year, would look at that and in many cases still go ahead and decide to clear the student based on their knowledge of what it means to consider safety issues. Within that small number, an even smaller number were brought forward to an advisory group that I've been convening once a month. It consists of eight of us from around campus, and that includes the Director of Student Conduct, a member of our General Counsel's office, a faculty member, people from our Dean of Students. We've let the Vice Provost, I'm getting my titles a little wrong here, our Vice President for Student Life and our Vice President for Equity and Inclusion were each invited to name somebody from their divisions to be on this group. And we also have the Student Counseling Office and the UO Police Department represented around the table. This has been a group that has only looked at the most serious of these cases, and the way we have presented this to them is we would not dream of denying a student admission based on this information unless that group could reach a consensus that it was cause for concern. We've tried to make this as transparent as we could by putting an FAQ webpage up. If any of you want to go to it, it's admissions.uoregon.edu/conduct. And we have to give a lot of credit to the University of Minnesota, who we copied mercilessly from, to create that site, knowing that Minnesota had already earned a great reputation for really taking care of the transparency piece and giving us the guidance that one of the simplest things we could do to set students at ease is take away the mystery of wondering what would or would not happen when they applied. If a student applied to us and they were on hold while we looked into this, a student who logged in privately to their online status page, which we call Duck Web, we never miss an opportunity for a good duck pun, they would simply see that they were under hold for review with very vague language that wouldn't give away much at all about what they said to us. We would link them to that FAQ page on that status page in case they'd never seen it before as a way to encourage them to see what was going on. We created a separate email account simply for my staff member who did the initial review, so that if they wanted to even ask her questions or get better guidance from her, they could talk with her privately about that. We even forwarded some files this year from her to the second round, or from the second round to the advisory group I met with, that we know in the future we won't have any intention of doing it, just so we could test out the proof of concept this first year of really making sure we all felt great about who was and wasn't getting forwarded to the second or to the third round. So whatever our statistics end up being, and we're not quite yet done with this year, but we will be in the next month or so, we have very much the intention of purposefully going to what we will consider a more normal approach to the percentage of cases we clear. While that number itself, of course, isn't the goal, we know enough about what we're seeing to know that we can have even more of these cases not go from the first round to the second round, much less to the third. All in all, the typical applicant who said yes to one of these questions this year was cleared before they had even finished doing things like getting in their high school transcript or their SAT scores or that one last recommendation letter they had decided to send. And we were very proud of this, not even slowing students down, much less changing the outcome. Nonetheless, we're going to be finding ways we can make this even better in the coming year. All along, I should emphasize that especially as it relates to the work of this group, criminal-related conduct cases, which are only a small percentage of what we saw this year, we very happily continue to welcome students with open arms who've gone through that process. We continue to be very proud to work through what's called the Inside Out program, and Shaw Cohen on our English and Honors faculty with inmates here in the Oregon Correctional System. We admitted two more of those just last week. This process is not keeping those students out as a general rule, and we've very carefully made sure there is really no one situation that would automatically result in denial. We are very much always wanting to take every case as it comes to us, looking for reasons to still be able to give that student a shot and see what we can do.
One of the important notes is as we wrap up the first year of this process, you know, we've had over 30,000 applicants. And the vast majority of incidents that students check are maybe student conduct related in high school, not anything that I think anyone in this group would find of a serious nature. And we're very cognizant that, tragically, in America, justice is not applied equally. And so many times we have groups of students that might be disadvantaged in the sense that they end up through a student conduct process or perhaps a criminal process in disproportionate rates. And so it's important for us to review. The other point that I would mention is for those students that we do find have answered affirmatively to a question, it also gives us an opportunity to provide them with guidance and assistance to services that the University of Oregon provides. So you might find that a student checks a box and it hypothetically it relates to perhaps some issues that they've had in their past with mental illness. This gives us an opportunity to admit the student, but more importantly, refer the student to the resources that are available on our campus that will provide them with the support that they need to be successful when they come to the University of Oregon. So there have been a number of benefits for us through this process beyond what it was intended to do.
If I can, just because I'm so intent upon you all hearing the confidentiality within this, within what Roger describes, I want to point out that even my advisory group who meets monthly is never told the identity of these students beyond what is absolutely necessary. They don't know whether they're in-state, out-of-state. They don't know their age. They don't know anything about them that isn't absolutely necessary to review the information. So in that case, when we get to an example like Roger gave of somebody who's on the way in being able to benefit from services we've had, that advisory group itself told me that they were fine and agreed that I should not give them the name at that point. So even then, those students are going to get a personal letter from me this summer with a brochure that simply lets them know privately that I would encourage them to know that these services are available. When we see that students already have great partners like sponsors or some of those other things we know they're able to access, we'll know they're well taken care of. But when they don't, we're going to make sure we offer this as an additional resource for them.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Mm-hmm. Paul, I'll call you on you in a second. But mm-hmm. can I just a request for those of you who are on the phone, could you make sure you're on mute? Thanks. Okay, Paul.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. First, I'd like to say a couple of things and then ask you a couple of questions. So I understand that, you know, this is being framed as a best practice. And as a person who works on policy issues on this body, as well as other bodies like the Governor's Reentry Council, I think we have been working hard to try and remove barriers for people with criminal histories. And I don't think that I would agree with you that this is a best practice. I think that when you take a look at how criminal records are being used systemically as it relates to employment, housing, academia, that the best practice is actually not to ask the question. So, and to give you a little personal perspective, I'm a U of O graduate from 1998. I applied in 96 as a result of an experience I had while I was in prison going to school and somebody recognizing that I had some abilities and encouraging me to continue my education. So when I got out, I applied to the U of O. The question was never asked, and I was allowed in. Under the current process, I don't know that I would have been allowed in. I had a significant criminal history. I had been kicked out of 3 high schools in Portland. You know, I graduated cum laude. So I think, you know, by putting barriers like this up, you're creating potential roadblocks for people. And the other thing I would add is that we know people of color are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And we have huge numbers of people in this country with criminal histories. 27% of the population now has an arrest record. 11% of adult males in this country now have a felony conviction. We know that education is one of the few things that we can do that has actually been proven to reduce recidivism. And a criminal history is a static factor. It's something that a person can't change. In community corrections, we use tools that tell us who are the people that are most likely to commit another crime. And there are a whole range of factors that we look at. Criminal history is one, and it's the only one that we can't change. So when you say you have a committee of people that look at these, to me, that doesn't seem very scientific. And again, I would go back to, you know, what is it that you're really trying to get at? If a person does have a significant criminal history, what does that tell you? Is that a predictor of future crime in your mind? Do you think that person is going to put other people at risk on the campus? I mean, because if that's the case, then that's a different conversation.
Well, I think I obviously can't speak to your own individual situation. I'm not prepared to do that. I think for us, our goal is to admit students to the University of Oregon. And we have applicants with criminal histories that are students enrolled today. Mm-hmm. But if we have a student, as an example, and I'm not saying this is, I would not want to violate a student's privacy, so I'm saying this is a complete hypothetical. If we were to have a student that had been suspended multiple times from their high school for threatening to bring firearms onto their campus, that is something we would like to know. I don't know whether it changes their admissions decision, and we ask students to give us more information about their individual situations, But we could go through a whole litany of things that might be important for us to know before we welcome someone into our community. We might have someone that had had issues around children and the way they interacted with children. We might not want that person to be working in our residence halls, as an example. That doesn't mean they can't be a student at the University of Oregon or earn their degree from the University of Oregon. So by asking these questions, there's nothing inherent in the questions that make us say, no, you're not admissible. It's simply an opportunity to gather more information. The vast majority of students who select one of these things have done, you know, they've ridden a skateboard through the library, for all we know. That's a student conduct issue. It's not anything of concern. I've given you two examples that might be a bit more concerning to us. And I think we have a responsibility to our students and to our families that entrust us with what matters most in their life, their daughters and sons, to at least be aware and to make a conscious decision whether someone who had threatened to bring firearms in that hypothetical example that I gave you is a risk to our community at large.
If I can, I'm sorry, were you done?
No, go ahead.
If I can, I want to first address what I thought was a great point you made, and I didn't mean for it to come across the wrong way. When we talk about best practices as a particular phrase we've been using here today, I'd very much want to limit that to among the ways you could do this if you're going to do it. And that's the only way in which I meant it. Okay. I think it's a very fair point you raise, and I really hope everyone knows how much we ourselves struggle with that balance between what does this possibly tell us in a rare number of cases, and what are the least damaging ways we can go about finding that out for those rare number of cases where it matters. It's also very much coming to our attention as we have a few questions come before the group and we say what is most concerning, that we get a better perspective again on the recency of events, the extremity of the events, the kind of idea where it may be that the person hasn't gotten the help they need or that something is still in progress. And so I think as we do that, it'll help us be not just more quick to clear students, but also maybe reframe some of the ways we ask and give guidance on how the students need to answer the questions and other things we can put on that FAQ site that'll hopefully set them at ease and let them know it'll be okay or that they don't need to cover certain things. It's a learning process for us as we go.
I also want to be clear. I don't believe because someone has a history, it makes them more inclined to recommit a crime or something of that nature. And in fact, it's why I said in the opening comments that we recognize that the criminal justice system is not blind. There are groups in America, tragically, that are overrepresented and disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. We know that occurs. That occurs in high school conduct classes, situations. That occurs in the criminal justice system.
So are you not bothered by that, though? I mean,
well, of course
I'm
bothered by that.
Be concerned about the fact that, you know, people of color are way overrepresented in the system, and you may have a white counterpart who committed the same crime but was never caught up in the system and may be just as much of a risk to you but doesn't have a criminal history?
Yes, I think it's one of the horrible things that happens in our country every day. But you're operating on an assumption we would deny that student based on them indicating that they had something in their background, and that's certainly not the case. In fact, what's happened in the last 6 years at the University of Oregon is that whether you're measuring any domestic minority group, as I said, we're up over 60%. We're at, knock on wood, we hope this fall we'll be at 29% minority students in our freshman class, plus another 9% from outside the country. So we would not do anything that we felt was in some way hampering our ability to recruit a more diverse freshman class. To be at 29% in a state with as little diversity as this state has, we're quite proud of it. And when you put it up against other public universities around the country, we're among the best.
One final question. So in your research in developing this policy, were you able to come up with any data that suggested knowing this information was a predictor of anything meaningful?
I'll even go more simply than talking about research to just say experience. And that is that in my 23 years in the admissions profession, three of which have now been here, we already learn about this on occasion about applicants, whether we ask right. the question or not. And the many institutions around the country who still don't ask this question, most would tell you they still, on rare, rare occasions, find the need to take that information to account. Again, not just because of a background, but because of much more specific details. What's changed in asking this question this year wasn't so much designed to say, if we find students who've done something, we'll make the campus safer. It was designed to say that it shouldn't be a haphazard process by which we happen to only hear because a disgruntled neighbor calls us, or because we happen to hear a story on the news that we learn about the very unusual situation, versus something that, as a process change, had a more unified, uniform way of finding this out. We don't think this will or that it should result in many denials of admission at all per year. And we don't think that because of that, it'll make for, say, some kind of obvious drop in crime statistics through the Clery Act or otherwise on our campus. And that one or two, maybe three cases a year, it's the thing that might never happen that we can feel, again, with the most strict, detailed discussion we can have. This might be the way that we prevented something from coming to pass that will never be able to be measured in a way that would be about a reduced statistic.
My final comment in response to that is you may not deny a lot of people, but you may find that people aren't applying because the question is on there. Mm-hmm. And our experience has taught us when people see the question on the front page of an application, whether it's for a job, whether it's for housing, they think this is just another barrier. I'm going to be denied. I'm not going to apply. So you're missing out on potentially a great pool of potential candidates.
So if I can respond to that, I appreciate your question, and I think that's probably accurate in housing, labor, other places. We're actually researching that as we implement this process. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence through year one that we had a chilling effect on anyone. In fact, across African American, Latino, Asian American, Native American, and two or more races, our applications are all up. Further, we took those students who started an application and did not finish the application, and we surveyed them for why it was they did not complete the application. And one of the options we gave them were the series of questions that we had asked. Mm-hmm. Completing an essay for admission far outranked this question. In fact, I think if I remember the data correctly, we had about a handful of students who indicated that this was an issue for them.
Less than
a handful, yeah. So I appreciate your question. We're constantly doing research to ensure that we're not doing that. My entire career has been built on making universities more diverse than when I arrived. At Indiana University, the University of Alabama, where we tripled the number of African Americans enrolled, at an institution where George Wallace stood in the door and said, please don't come. And he didn't even use the word please.
Well, he didn't say
so,
please.
Yeah, he didn't say please. So we would, I guess I say this, you can, you know, this and $3 will buy you a Starbucks, I guess. But I would offer my sincere, my word that we would not wish to do anything that would diminish the progress we have made in the last 7 years in making our campus more diverse. It's from those measures, it's more than doubled in the 6.5 years I've been at the University of Oregon, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of. So we will continue to do research to see if in any way we're discouraging students from applying. But at least through year one, we're up in all those categories, which is one of the measures that matters most to us, and we're surveying students who begin an application and don't complete it, and we're not finding that this set of questions has anything to do with whether they complete the application or not.
Okay, Janet.
Yeah, I just have a couple of questions, and thank you for your presentation.
Sure.
And you may not be able to answer this one, but maybe you know. So my impression, I'm just curious what proportion of your student population actually is older in the sense that they might have gone to an institution and come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, my stereotype, I guess, is that you'd have a predominantly young population
That's
of kids
correct.
That are coming in from high school. And I know from our work in Marion County, I'm looking at Paul to affirm that in Lane County, the people who come out of prison and actually go to a four-year university tend to be the ones that are kind of the high achievers that have really done well. You wouldn't, I don't know that you would find a lot of people that are struggling that would apply to a four-year university. And so then my other part of my question is, community colleges tend to be where most of our folks start out, and just wondering how that relationship works between U of O and community colleges. So sure. Maybe like six questions in one, but if you could
take a crack and respond to it. There's several things I hear within this that are just about describing our applicant pool. I think Roger will trust me to just rattle some of them off pretty easily. Mm-hmm. When Roger mentioned that we had 30,000 applications for undergraduate admission this fall, I'd say about 22,000 of them were students seeking first-time freshman admission. 99-point-something percent of those were straight out of high school, although there's occasionally the student who finished high school a while ago but is just now starting college. Of those students who are applying as transfer applicants, we would call them, meaning they've done something somewhere else at a college level but haven't earned a bachelor's degree, it's a pretty even mix of in-state, out-of-state, of students coming from two-year and four-year schools. I don't think I could give you the exact statistics on the age distribution of those, but I would say on the whole it skews more towards the traditional student than the non-traditional.
Gone 2 years in community college.
And in that regard, our applicant pool in no way should be thought to reflect the overall population of Oregon or any other slice. It's a particular subset that's seeking not only a university degree, but at the University of Oregon.
60% of all transfer applicants and all students who enroll at the University of Oregon, 60% come from an Oregon community college. And you can actually narrow that even further to Lane Community College, Portland Community College, Clackamas Community College.
I just think it might be interesting for our group to really kind of get a sense of where those folks that are coming in for reentry actually are showing up in the system. I mean, U of O may be a place, but it may not be the predominant place. And how does this apply kind of across the institutions that we have in Oregon? So then the other question that I have, and I want to play devil's advocate a bit to the approach that Paul had, and I'm not suggesting that this is a concern of mine. I just want to know, I'm sure it's a concern of our communities and how you address it. So liability always pops up in these kinds of instances. And my, again, my sense would be that there could be the argument that whether you ask the question or whether you not ask the question. So if you don't ask the question at all and you don't know, and then something happens, then people say, well, why didn't you ask the question, right? And then if you do ask the question, but you do it in the way that you're doing, and something egregious happens, what liability are you in because you knew? You know what I'm saying? And so I'm sure you've had attorneys that have looked at all of this, and so I just kind of want to understand what the landscape looks like around that issue.
Absolutely. You've hit the issue for why this is new for us. So when I arrived at the University of Oregon from Indiana University in Bloomington, we had asked a question similar to this for quite some time. And we did it primarily for the reason that Jim alluded to. We were what we called it the Mrs. Kravitz syndrome, right? So if you're familiar with the neighbor from a television show in the 60s, she, you know, this is what we were experiencing at Indiana. Some neighbor calls and says, hey, this, I saw this kid egg a house, you shouldn't admit him to IU, kind of thing. And so we were asking the question at that time. When I came to the University of Oregon in my second year, I felt that this was an issue that we should probably address in some form. And at that time, I think it's fair to say in a public forum that our general counsel very much took the approach of we shouldn't ask this question because if you guys miss something, if someone checks a box or something and you miss it somehow and something egregious occurs, then, you know, we're more liable in the sense. The reality is, heaven forbid something awful happens at the University of Oregon, it's not going to matter whether you know, we had a series of questions or not. It's going to be an awful situation where families will experience something none of us even wish to imagine. And some of this was highlighted post-Virginia Tech, to be honest. And it created a situation where I think in higher education today, when we talk about this at various conferences, there's two primary concerns. You know, it's sort of a student with a violent history that could become an active shooter. And I completely agree with what you've stated. There's no way you're going to predict what someone's going to do by asking this. And the second is sexual assault. You know, one in five women, and Jim and I are both the fathers of daughters at the University of Oregon. Oregon. One in five women on college campuses become victims of sexual assault. And it's the reason we added the third question related to stalking and those kinds of things. And Jim didn't allude to it, and actually I probably shouldn't say it because it would reveal the student's identity. But part of what highlighted this for us was a student before we had the question that had a long history and very problematic in this area that was brought to our attention, and all you had to do was go Google after that and you could read the details. So I appreciate what you're saying. We moved in this direction because we tell families all the time that we're going to create an environment where their students can be successful, where they can learn and study in a place where they can focus on those issues. Jim's already told you. Very few students mark any of these three boxes, and the overwhelming majority of those, 99 point something, we're admitting. So we it's a very difficult position for any university to be in, and heaven forbid something happens to a young person in the kinds of dramatic ways that we've seen at other places.
You know, I guess if I could just follow up on Janet's question, I mean, your first point about the person who would apply for entry at the U of O, who, you know, very likely will have started at community college, will have had some experience, you know, with education, maybe had some experience inside the institution, had it at the community college, or in some more exceptional circumstances might go directly from the institution to the community college, to the university. You know, that's probably going to be a pretty special person, right? And, you know, perhaps even someone who's going to be less likely to commit an offense than the ordinary population, right? And I'm just wondering if there are studies out there, you know, that you've looked at that indicate that we really should be worried about, you know, the risks posed by ex-offenders coming in any more than we would be to anyone in the general population.
I'd say especially drawing in that advisory group I assemble when needed that includes a lot of student affairs professionals who have much more experience with counseling than us. We hear a lot of this being about the idea not just what's happened with that student, but how they seem to have responded to it.
That's right.
The students who are able to speak to rehabilitation, reentry, any of those kinds of things in a way that we can see some real sincerity, and that's been easier to spot than I thought it would in my first experiences here on this campus this year, they come through pretty quickly. Whereas the students who have just done something and are very defensive and cryptic about it, even just something as simple as not saying much, and then when our staff say, well, we don't even have enough to go on here, can you tell us more, and they won't even respond, that in and of itself is a sign for us. I can say that happened a few enough times this year that I could count it on one hand and have a finger or two left. But again, those are the kind of students that we were mainly looking at, and that does tie to research and conversations that student counseling professionals tell us really drives home not just what's happened, but what's going on with the student afterward as part of that very important dividing line there.
I think one of the areas, and it's the reason we're asking students who don't complete the application what the reasoning for that is, or for what the reason is, you know, the study that's been done around this topic in higher education relates to the SUNY system. And I am a little uncomfortable saying it in a public setting, but, you know, I don't think their approach is very valuable, nor do I think it is ethical or equitable to students. And we intentionally tried to build a system that was very different from that. But I think most of the research has keyed around what's happened in New York. And when you have a simple set of questions, and anyone who answers yes is denied, that's at one end of the spectrum from where we are at the other end, and that's intentional. But I think there's more research right. needed in this area, Senator, and we're anxious to continue to do our work to see if what our students are telling us.
Just looking at the experience at the U of O, there was nothing at the U of O that precipitated this,
no.
right? I mean, it's not that you had a problem, and this was the solution to it. It was a concern about a potential problem.
I would say, going back to the example I gave earlier and that Roger's spoken to, we have come across this information more haphazardly before. And in that regard, instituting this process gives us a more, if not perfect, predictable way to get at this information. And so there was that goal in instituting this. There was certainly a reason for instituting this. But the notion is that there is no one answer we're going to get that says that's what we're trying to keep out, and we're going to automatically say no. It's about a very carefully chosen piece of information that will help us in a tiny number of instances per year. And we try to make it as quick and gone and behind them as we can for everybody else.
I'd just like to respond to the issue around sexual assaults. I also have daughters that attend U of O, and
thank you.
Have concerns about their safety as young women on a college campus, given what we know about sexual assault, what we know about college athletics, and the predominance of sexual assault that occurs in those environments. But what I would say is people who are convicted of sex offenses reoffend at very, very low rates. When they're on supervision, they're required to do polygraphs, they're required to register. They have a lot of strings attached to them. So as I think about my daughters at the University of Oregon, I have no faith at all that you identifying somebody who's been convicted of a past sex offense is going to make them any safer. I think the safety in this issue has to do with the culture. And many of the offenses that are committed by people who have never been convicted of crimes. In fact, I would say most of the assaults on college campuses, sexual assaults, are committed by people who've never been convicted of crimes. So I guess I would challenge that piece being used as any reasonable way of looking at making the campus safer or hanging your hat on that particular issue.
Yes, and I guess I would clarify, we're not trying to hang our hat on sexual assault. I simply offered that as an illustration of some of the topics that are being discussed in higher education with concern. I agree with much of what you said. I would not want to single out student athletes as perpetrators of sexual assault when we know there's many other groups, and it typically sexual assault on college campuses runs with substance abuse issues or other things beyond student athletes. I worry sometimes in the popular press that we can get in this habit of labeling student athletes as if they're more likely to commit these kinds of sexual assaults, and I don't think that's accurate. The data doesn't support that. Just the 1 in 5, there wouldn't be enough student athletes alone, but they're all difficult issues, and reasonable people can see many sides to this issue. And I guess from our perspective, we're simply trying to do our best to ensure that the really, I don't want to say egregious, but that we're reviewing situations that might be concerning to our community. And the vast majority, overwhelmingly, we're saying yes to those students anyway, but we're happy to at least have some knowledge.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you both. I think you've given us a lot to chew on. Did you have anything?
No, it strikes me that, frankly, the concerns that I've seen have not been so much with admissions. It's, in fact, once a student has been admitted, is taking classes, ends up telling some of that history, that tends to create a problem for staff, professors, et cetera. And I'm not sure that we're addressing that at this particular point. I understand what you're doing in terms of the admissions, but...
You're saying if the student themselves shares
yes.
that? Interesting.
In my experience, students will take the class and mention that they've had this kind of experience, and that then creates significant tension.
Mm-hmm.
work between them and the professors and our fellow students that creates a problem for those students, and eventually, and it gets weirdly resolved in different ways. So it's not so much, I mean,
right.
You know, that first step that admissions is one thing, but the next step in terms of the culture, how the community in a university or college deals with it is another issue altogether.
You're right.
If I can, because even if this isn't exactly what you're talking about, I wonder if it'll raise this question for people. I do hear within the scenario you're describing something that some of you might wonder later, and that is that, like most colleges that ask these questions, we do tell students if they have background like this that they fail to disclose, that it could jeopardize their admission later. While there are institutions out there that will be very heavy-handed about that, where if the student suddenly lets it out a few years later and somebody says, why didn't you disclose it? We haven't had it in place long enough for this to happen. But B, I'd just like to really drive home with everyone to understand our mentality towards this. There's nothing automatic with the way we're approaching this. So even if we encounter a student later who came in without mentioning this, then we learn about it later. I mean, for the very reasons this task force is charged with thinking about, there's all kinds of baggage behind a student having a very difficult decision to share that with us. And I can assure you that whenever it is that might come up, we'll want to see all sides of that as well. Because we know there's a lot that student has to think through when they share that.
I think Representative Frederick's referring more to the culture of the campus and how the interactions take place.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, let me ask one question. The decision to include misdemeanors as well as felonies, what was the reason for that?
Well, that came.
I'd say that with advice from general counsel and from things we've heard from other institutions around the country, that especially because certain things fall into a little bit more of a gray area than others on various types of crimes and how things may vary from state to state, that we were better off to cast the wide net than the narrow one there. Again, I'm no criminal expert. We've relied very heavily on other people's advice and guidance here. So we've started with that, and that's one of the many things we'll continue to look at in regards to what we see and what we do and don't need to see in the future as we continue to fine-tune this.
49 other states with different laws, and probably the only thing in common is that justice is not applied equally or equitably, depending on the person's background, and we acknowledge that.
I want to put basically a flag out there. One of the concerns that I have about student records is that now those student records are no longer in moldy file cabinets in middle school. They are, in fact, electronic and online. So a fight or something else that somebody does at seventh grade could conceivably be part of that record now. And it is a concern of mine about mm-hmm. where those records are, who has control of them, who they pass along to. So that's just something, just to keep that in mind.
That's exactly why only 5 people on our campus can get at it. And we test that actually pretty frequently.
But it is not just your 5 that concern me. Those kinds of records, especially now as part of a larger data set that we're starting to pick up on individual students, that's a concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jim and Roger. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Did you have a comment?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Yeah, come on. Why don't you come up, and then you can speak in a mic.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. I wanted to speak a little bit to trying to ensure that there's not a chilling effect, and I appreciate you doing those follow-up surveys to try to find that out. I think, though, to be willing to check that box to say that these questions were the reason that I didn't complete would be, in essence, the same as checking the box on the application. And I think there would be a real disincentive mm-hmm. to share that information honestly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I said I think the more important measure for us is that across every ethnicity in our applicant pool, we're up And that's in a state in Oregon where high school graduates are declining, and particularly in a state where African-American graduation rates, this state should be embarrassed and appalled at how low they are when you're competing with Detroit. So for us to be up as high as we are across all groups, I think is one of the indicators to me that would suggest that there is no chilling effect.
I'm not sure that that's fair to look necessarily at the race, the ethnic backgrounds of the individuals who are applying to say whether that's having a chilling effect on your applicant pool, particularly when Oregon is a predominantly white state. I'm not sure that that would get you the accurate information. I'm simply saying that I'm not sure that the method you're using to obtain that information is necessarily reflective of what's going on.
I don't disagree. We're trying to use as many methods ideas as we can. Yeah.
When we did this year, I've been talking regularly with counterparts at about 35 or 40 other major public institutions around the country who do similar things. We're the first one to do this. And we know it was flawed, but we figured it was something more than anyone else had tried, and we'd welcome other ideas about how we can really have more of a fact than hunch-based way of looking at this. We're interested in additional ways to know. We're looking at what we can figure out to look at. We'd love ideas.
Yeah, thank you. Well, and with respect to doing everything that you can, and I appreciate the things that you're doing on your end to try not to create any sort of a slowdown for the student in the application process, I think it's a little short-sighted to only think about that side of the slowdown. The slowdown that happens for a student who has to check that box, think through whether it's worth it to check that box, because what might be the possible implications of doing so, and then have to think through, how do I explain this in a way that someone who's on a who I will never see, who will never know me as an individual and the other aspects of what I bring, how do I explain this in a way that they will understand? And I think that creates an enormous slowdown for that potential student, and creates perpetuates this underclass of people who have to explain themselves, when many times they would need to explain a system. And I think it's putting those folks in a situation where not only have they perhaps been, particularly when you're talking about suspension records and things, and we look at the disproportionate numbers of African-American students who are removed from classrooms on a daily basis for reasons that are not disciplinary, that to explain that would seem nearly impossible for some individuals. And I just wonder that whether, there's an enormous slowdown for the student, and whether they actually follow through is another question altogether.
And I can assure you that is on our minds.
Yeah.
We talked with the several hundred high school counselors we know around the state of Oregon this past fall, to let them know this was coming and encourage them in any case where they thought this might be a hindrance for a student, to A, encourage the student not to keep them from applying, and B, for that counselor to feel free themselves or the student to be directly in touch with me. I got about 3 or 4 phone calls this year as a result of that. I don't know how many more I didn't get,
yeah.
Right? We don't know what we can't measure. But I do know in all 4 of those cases, we were able to talk through that the student decided to apply, and they've all been admitted. I've actually kept track of that.
That's a good
there's 4
thing.
Wins.
Yeah.
Right?
That's 4. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. I think there's a lot to think about here, but we also have to think about housing. So we'll move on to that topic. Thank you very much, Jim, Roger, and Libby. Okay, our next item is talking about access to housing. And, housing has been one of the things that we've been, that is part of the charge of this committee. The challenges that ex-offenders face in finding housing, even more so than the general population. And, I think that we are committed to looking at barriers that are there that we can perhaps do something with. And promised last time to invite in representatives of the landlords to see the world through their eyes in terms of the challenges that they face when renting to ex-offenders, and also just to get some of our kind of technical questions about how it works. Is there a box, and why is there a box, and that sort of thing. So we have Ryan Fisher's here, and Cindy Robert. Yeah, and on the phone, Deborah. I don't know if you want to weigh in on this as well. I would hope so. And is there anyone else on the phone that is from the housing world on the landlord side?
Yes.
That's Deborah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And great. Yes, I'm happy to weigh in as the conversation goes.
Okay.
Super. Was Kim Travis on the line too from Oregon Housing and Community Services? I believe she was on the call at the beginning.
I don't know. Kim Travis, are you on?
I'm on the phone, yes.
Okay, great. Okay, well, Ryan and Cindy, you want to come over here?
Senator, if I can remind you that years ago, most of us are watching the hearing via video feed, and there's a delay when you pick up the phone, so it may appear like we're disconnected, but it just takes a minute before we get the difference between video feed and telephone audio.
That's right. That's great. Yes. I know. So people are watching it online. Thanks, Eddie. So I don't know who wants to start. Tell us what the practice is as far as renting to ex-offenders within the constituencies that you work with.
So my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon. And I actually reached out to a few of the landlords and some of the other landlord groups, as well as including ORHA, and asked them about this. In 2013.
I'm sorry. If you could have her speak into the microphone a little more, it's hard to hear.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's one of
these. I don't even
think
they work.
Here.
They don't work. Sears work?
Maybe it does, but
they should be.
They're to pick up.
Yeah, not,
can you hear me now?
Yeah, so, yes. They're so, yeah, they're for the online way of watching this. So, Jeremy, are you on the phone, or are you also listening?
I'm on the phone. Maybe I should switch.
How about that one? Can we do that one? Here we go. Thanks, Cheyenne.
If it'll reach. I don't know if it will.
I'm set with Representative Frederick.
That's fine.
Come on, Ryan. Gosh. Can you hear me better now?
Perfect.
Oh, fabulous. So in 2013, we passed Senate Bill 91, which was a piece of legislation put together by the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which is a group that meets during the interim to really talk about some of the more difficult issues between landlords and tenants and come up with a bill that we can bring to the legislature, all agree to, and not have to fight about it at the legislature. And, oftentimes we're told when we're doing opposing sides and testifying the committee, you guys go out and you figure this out and bring us something back. Well, we just do that in advance. We bring them something in advance of the very first hearing. And in 2013, one of those issues in 91 and Senate Bill 91 had to do with criminal history. And it said that a landlord may not consider eviction history when screening applicants and may not consider a landlord may not consider arrest history and evaluating an applicant where the arrest did not result in charges, which are still pending. So if they're out there but they didn't result in anything and they haven't been concluded, they cannot be considered. And I said the landlord cannot consider eviction history when screening applicants. And the only time a landlord may consider a criminal conviction is if it is in the is not more than 5 years old. So if it's more than 5 years old, it cannot be considered. And if it's a drug-related crime, a person crime, a sex offense, or financial fraud. So we really narrowed what could be considered. And again, that Senate Bill 91, if you all want to look at that, Again, the eviction judgment cannot be an eviction judgment cannot be held against someone for more than 5 years either. So we have been trying to figure out, many landlords trying to figure out different ways to mitigate some of the higher risk that sometimes comes with people who we don't have a rent history for or who don't have roots somewhere that we can look into. And in a lot of cases, the natural inclination is to raise the security deposit for those folks. Unfortunately, this doesn't bode well because a lot of these folks don't have the extra income. So we're looking at different ways to make sure that there's some kind of assistance. Now, many of you know that Section 8 of Section 8 bill was passed. It helps to put money into a mitigation fund to help those people who may have helped those landlords who may have run into problems with some of their tenants who have left, and there's no way to pay for the damages. So we set up a mitigation fund for Section 8. And one of the things that the landlord groups have been talking about is a similar mitigation fund for damages from other folks who don't have a rental history that we can look at. Frankly, the renter rehab program, which I think you all heard about, Salvation Army and Eugene runs it. Okay. It gives classes to potential tenants. A lot of times it is people who are on the reentry world and tells them how to be a good tenant. And at the end they receive a certificate of completion. And many landlords in Lane County, I was told by one of their representatives there, really consider this as an important factor, and they will overlook some of the things that they could otherwise consider, even though that's narrow as well, if this certification is in fact brought forward. So when Zoe was talking to me about the things that she would be interested in hearing about here, it was what makes a good landlord, and I mean a good tenant to a landlord, and what kind of things do you want them to know about? And this program is a perfect example of the kind of things that landlords want their tenants to know about the different things that are their responsibilities, the different ways of handling those responsibilities, different resources available to them if they're not doing well and need more help. So that is one really good piece as well. So a mitigation fund, like a Section 8, a renter rehab program, like what we have in Eugene. And then we do run into one problem area, and that problem area is a little bit of a conundrum in that the Fair Housing Act says that we have to have policy, landlords have to have policies in place that they apply equally to everybody. So if I have a policy as a landlord in place that I require a credit score of 600, I require three or more times the rent for your salary, I require a year worth of satisfactory background residential work that you've done, or you know, some kind of contract you've been in before. If I require all those things of people, I have to require them of all people. Otherwise, I'm considered to be discriminating. So how do we, in fact, go about making some special provisions for people in this situation without then being discriminated against other people who aren't in this particular situation, but we do require certain things from? That's one of the things for us to consider as well, and it's one of the balancing acts that we've had to play as we've tried to figure out how to adjust to Senate Bill 91 of 2013, because it is an adjustment for us as well.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, we'll come back to you, Cindy. Ryan?
All right. So my name is Ryan Fisher, and I represent the Oregon Housing Authorities, and that's the Statewide Association of Housing Authorities. In addition to doing government relations work for them, we also do their association management, which means that every quarter we put together a meeting where all of the statewide directors come together, and we work with them in that regard. So what I wanted to talk about a little bit is, first of all, some of the strategies that housing authorities have been doing, and it's so great that you're here, because one of the things housing authorities rely on is partnerships, and the partnership in Lane County with sponsors has been remarkable. I had a chance to tour Roosevelt Crossing, which I would highly recommend to members of this task force. It's just a remarkable partnership between a housing provider and a service provider that is doing just incredible work. Through the work with the housing authorities, we've been involved in a really interesting piece of work in partnership with the Oregon Law Center, which is the legal aid provider in the state, and Multifamily Northwest, which it, Deborah's on the phone, and so I'm going to lean on Deborah if I get something wrong here. So don't hesitate to jump in, Deborah. Last year, a huge law passed in the Supreme Court, and it didn't get as much attention as it might have otherwise, because it happened in between two other huge Supreme Court rulings, the Marriage Equality Act and the upholding of the ACA. This literally happened all in one week, and this one was the one that was in the middle. And what this ruling did is it upheld this concept of disparate impact. And so for the last year, with funding from Meyer Memorial Trust, these three organizations that I mentioned have been putting together education around this concept of disparate impact. And it's a head scratcher of a concept when you first come across it. But a lawyer who explained it to me in a way that I could understand talked about a historical case in the South where there was a fire department that didn't want to hire women, and they said no women can apply, and they got sued as violating a protected class, and they lost the lawsuit. So they changed their policy. They said you have to be 6 feet tall to be a fighter here. And they got sued again. And because the plaintiff was able to show that there was a statistical percentage of women that were below 6 feet that was much higher than the statistical percentage of men that were below 6 feet, that policy had a disparate impact on the protected class. And even though on its face it appeared to be neutral, in practice it was discriminatory, and therefore it was in violation. What the Supreme Court held up is that that same concept applies to housing. And this is a huge shift in the way that fair housing law will be interpreted. And Deborah and I were just in Eastern Oregon, was that last week or maybe 2 weeks ago? I've lost track. But talking about this it is a huge change. And I would say that, you know, I've heard in this room several times today, it's a well-understood fact that our criminal justice system is not equitable. And that fact, I don't think, however, is widely known everywhere. And so I think that when you tell somebody who doesn't understand that fact that screening for certain criminal backgrounds has a disparate impact and is not a legal fair housing practice, I think that there is some confusion about why that is. And I think that that's something that really needs to be addressed. The way that a disparate impact case works is first the tenant has to show how the policy is unfair. You have to show that there are more women who are under 6 feet tall than over 6 feet tall. Then the defendant has to show why there's a business reason for that practice. You have to be able to reach a certain ladder or something like that. Then the plaintiff would have to show another policy that would answer that business case without having this disparate impact. And we're seeing that in housing as well. And the biggest area where this is going to have an immediate impact is on screening for criminal background. Perhaps the most interesting and enlightening portion of this trip that we just took was when we were in Pendleton, and we brought someone from the Community Corrections Department to come up and address the landlords. And he started by saying, look, what you do all day when you're looking at applications, you're assessing risk. My job is assessing risk. That's what I'm trained to do. When I'm assessing risk, there are eight domains that we look at that help us understand what is somebody's risk to reoffend. Their criminal history is the least informative of those eight domains. And, you know, you could have heard a pin drop in the room when he said this. And then later on, he was just as surprised when he said, so, you know, he's asking this room full of landlords, is the one thing that you're most concerned about when you're going through these applications, criminal history? And all the heads started nodding. And he said, wow, we really need to talk, because I can help provide you with a lot of indicators that are going to be a lot more helpful for you in screening. You know, what are they doing with their free time? And he just listed off of these sorts of things. So I think my point here is that there are two things to think about. One is that these screening criteria are not going to be allowed moving forward based on this Supreme Court. There will be certain, you know, statistically you can get into details and some will be more adverse than others. But the other is that they're not doing what the landlords want them to do. If I go by what this community corrections person is saying. The last thing I want to mention is something that Cindy mentioned, which is we had at Housing and Community Services, we had a fund that could be used similar to the Landlord Guarantee Fund prior to that bill. That money got swept and put in to fund this Landlord Guarantee Fund, which is specifically for the Housing Choice Voucher or the Section 8 program. And we agree with Cindy that original program needs to come back because there are folks who are not holding a housing choice voucher who have a criminal background who were previously able to get some sort of a landlord guarantee through this program that are not if they don't have that housing choice voucher. And so I think in the 2017 legislature, it's essential that we bring that program back. And as Cindy mentioned, it's typically connected to the person completing some sort of a ready-to-rent or rent-well program and having a certificate to show that their participation. And then the landlord could potentially tie that to a guarantee against damages should there be any with that tenant.
Ryan, can I jump in a little bit?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I wanted the group to know is that in addition to the Supreme Court ruling, HUD came out in April with and what they called an outline or guidelines around disparate impact. And they basically said in that guidance, which was as is somewhat typical of HUD, was pretty vague, but it basically said that if you are screening for criminal background, you are in fact having a disparate impact on people of color. And they're supposed to be coming out with additional guidelines, around the whole concept. But I know that our organization is already, we've met with screening companies and our attorneys, and we are already looking at changing our recommendations around screening criteria. And specifically, what HUD is trying to get at is that you're doing some kind of individualized analysis. And so we're looking at, some landlords have an appeal process, some don't, some have something in between, so we're also taking a look at things around that appeal process. But getting back to what Cindy said, this is so different for landlords because forever, fair housing has always been about consistency and having the same rule and the same policy. And now we're talking about, having an individualized assessment. And, how do you make sure that you are being, that we're working on getting rid of the barriers, but we're also being equitable and fair and consistent in that process?
Yes, Janet.
So this is all great information, and thank you for being here. Just a couple questions. I was familiar with the HUD guidance. I had not heard about the Supreme Court ruling, so appreciate that. So if that all goes away, then maybe I don't even need answers to my questions. But I just want to, number one is using the background check system that has been used for folks that at least I've been working with, and one person that I advocate for, they don't look at convictions, they look at arrests, and also we found that depending on which background check service you use can make a huge difference about whether or not it's accurate, it contains all the notes or whatever, because oftentimes someone will get charged with a bazillion things and then they only get convicted of maybe one thing or two things, but on their arrest record all those other things stay. So that was one of the pieces. The second piece is that the friend that I advocate for had to pay for the background check, and she was applying to multiple places because she's getting turned down. $75 a piece, something like that, a lot of money for her. I mean, she's on SSI, she makes $705 a month, and so it's really a chilling effect just to get the background check. And then the other piece that I was curious about is if if the background check goes away, are there still requirements around insurance? And if somebody doesn't drive and doesn't have insurance, how does that play in? And credit, like a credit check, how that works. And Paul may, again, have more information about how it impacts Lane County. But those are the things that I found have been really kind of barriers in getting people into housing other than just their ability to pay the rent and also the waiting list on Section 8, which tends to be really long.
So I'm going to try to start from the beginning. The first question you asked was really about arrests that didn't lead to conviction. And the law is very specific. It says that it has to, when evaluating the applicant, a landlord may not consider previous arrests of the applicant if the arrest did not result in a conviction.
Right, I heard that. The issue is how experienced are landlords in recognizing the difference on a background check between an arrest and a conviction?
I think they're really able to differentiate. The question is, how do you get a background check on someone and read it? And as humans, just as humans,
right, exactly.
How do you say, I'm not going to consider that, but I am going to consider this? And I was looking back at my testimony on this issue back in 2013, and that was something I raised then. How do you expect someone to do that? Unless we say the background check folks can't even report this, we don't say that. We just say the landlord can't consider it. So right. One angle to consider.
And could I ask you a follow-up? Because, you know, I'm not experienced with this domain at all. Can the landlord refuse to rent for any reason? I mean, do they have to justify the reason that they're not renting to the individual?
A landlord could certainly say that they don't want to rent to someone, but they're likely to be sued. I mean that's the key here, is for so many reasons. And in this, they could say you are being sued because you didn't in fact consider the criminal history. Well, how do you know that the person actually considered it? I mean, that's one of the biggest problems in landlord-tenant law from our perspective, from the landlord perspective, is wait a minute, how do you know what our intent was? But we spend a lot of time in court arguing about the intent.
But I mean, do they have to explain why they're not renting to the person?
No.
They don't. There is a scenario where if somebody felt that because of their background they had been discriminated against and they reported it to Fair Housing, one of the things that Fair Housing of Oregon might do is send two people to apply to that same landlord. One, and they would be identical in every way except one would have an arrest on their record and the other would not. And if the one without the arrest was given the place and the one with was not, then that would be grounds for a Fair Housing case.
But there's an aspect to this that is important. Fair Housing doesn't have a lot of people to do that. They aren't able to go out and do that kind of checkup on a regular basis. In many cases, that the folks who have been turned down do not have the ability, the legal ability, just financial legal ability to pursue that kind of a case. So in many cases, it's not pursued because you just don't. I mean, having been turned down, and I found out later on that it was I don't want to rent to black people. Having seen that take place, I didn't at the time have any ability, even though it was on the books that you couldn't do that, I didn't have any ability to really challenge that.
So I would argue, respectfully, Representative, that while that is true and that does happen to people all the time, it happens to landlords as well, where they don't have the money and the tenant can go to legal aid, the law center, and get some assistance. And they're very good at law center at responding to tenant needs, that a lot of times the landlord doesn't have that resource either.
It's often, I think, a scale situation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
If someone who's a tenant or wanting to be a tenant, and you're dealing with a larger landlord group that tends to have a legal background and have a legal team
in-house,
you're not going to do very well. And in the same way, if you are a mom and pop like I am, I mean, I own a duplex, and if somebody decided I would have a rough time going into a legal situation just because of the cost.
And you just put your finger on something that's a good point that maybe skews my conversation a little bit, and that's I have 1,800 members, 81% of whom own 10 or fewer units. Yes. So I consider myself kind of the mom-and-pop group. But you're right, there's scales that come into it, certainly. Our goal is to make it so that we educate all the landlords of all sizes of the things that they need to be doing to do this correctly. And we work really hard. I think Deborah's group, my group, Rental Housing, Oregon Rental Housing Association, based out of Eugene, I think they work very hard trying to go around the state and educate our members so they're doing it the right way. I'm sorry. Now I can't remember what your other questions are. If you just give me some kind of flag, I'll...
Well, I was just commenting on the cost of multiple background checks, insurance, and credit.
Yes, and insurance in this, actually, I think it might have even been the same bill in the same year. We did actually allow for landlords to require insurance.
Rental insurance. Right, but this would be requiring some sort of insurance check in order to get into housing. Is there anything like that or not necessarily?
You can require that they show that they can get rental insurance.
That they can just get rental insurance, but not...
Not that
auto insurance or have any other
not at all. No auto insurance. There's nothing conversation about that.
And then credit.
And then the credit checks are expensive. You're right. And, maybe, at least from my alliance's standpoint, we'd like to think that if you have one, you could use it in other places. So if you pay a landlord the money to do a credit check, you actually own it. So is there a way that we can somehow... It's your credit. It's not theirs. It's yours.
This is Deborah. Can I jump in on that?
Yeah.
Just recently in King County and possibly another couple of counties as well, they have authorized a portable background check. So it didn't go as far as... All landlords having to accept it, but they have to say whether they do or don't accept it. So that the tenant can take this background check, and the landlord associations and tenant groups work together to decide what that was going to look like and be uniform. And it doesn't have a lot of history behind it yet because it just went into effect July 1st. But that could be something that we took a look at.
Absolutely. And landlords can currently make that decision. They're just not forced to.
Great. Yes, Paul.
Prior to this ruling, there was no real recourse for people with criminal histories. They aren't a protected class.
No.
And so I guess the question I have is, certainly litigating is one way to get doors open, but... As a nonprofit provider that works with people coming out of the system, we're constantly looking for ways to incentivize or encourage landlords to rent to our folks. So I like this idea of an indemnification pool for non-Section 8 folks or any other tools that we can use. And I think, Ryan, you hit on a great point that, criminal history is one thing, and I tried to bring this up earlier, that really doesn't tell us that much. If what we're concerned about is predictors of future crime, then criminal history is not necessarily the best thing to use. So is there a way that we can... talk to rental owners associations, bring community corrections with us to talk about, you know, what are the benefits, what are the things we should look for, how can we work to partner with them in ways that will assuage their concerns. So that's my first comment. The other thing...
Hey, Paul, before you go on, let me just jump in. You know, at our last meeting, Jeremy talked to us about, I forget what it's called, but the certificate that...
of rehabilitation?
Certificate of good standing.
Good standing,
Certificate of good standing that they have been piloting at Mercy Corps, where a person, you know, goes through a process and a panel sort of gives them, you know, the good... You know, the good housekeeping seal. And, you know, if that, something along those lines could also be part of this program. Because that's the purpose of, that's the main purpose of your program, isn't it, Jeremy? Is to open up housing.
Absolutely, yeah. Give them a tool to sort of evaluate applications that might give them pause initially.
And that could perhaps be connected to a mitigation fund.
Absolutely.
You point to a dilemma here, though. If we make it so you can't consider any of it anyway, you don't even need this fund. But, I mean, I'm not sure which direction you all want to go in, but I certainly think that that's something to think about. Which way do we want to go? We want to make it so that we can prove over time to landlords that this isn't a problem and have a backup pot of money in case it is? Or do we just want to say they can't do it and watch a lot of landlords, you know, leave the industry? You know, that's a decision I think you have to make. And Senator, I am so apologetic. I have a little boy who I have to get to a basketball game, so I need to leave in 5 minutes. So if anyone wants to ask me a specific question, I mean, Deborah can answer, Ryan can answer, but
I have a follow up for Ryan. But
oops, we lost you, Jeremy. And why a basketball, you know, even the NBA season ended last week.
I know, he made it to the 12 in high school rookie team, so for a freshman next year, yeah.
All right, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
All right, so Senate Bill 91, you said that there was a number of types of crimes that extend beyond the five-year limit. You know, in my work, most of the people I work with have those crimes. Do you see a potential to sort of work on lowering the sheer amount of time that people have to wait, or bringing it back down to 5 years for those specific crimes? Or where do you think that is a route that your group would be willing to look back into?
So forgive me, Jeremy, for the fact that I actually ran together two issues when I first started talking. It's the eviction history that cannot be considered after 5 years. The criminal background does not have a date specific or timeline on it. What it has...
Okay, good. Okay. I've got to say, I've been spending the last 30 minutes being like, wow, I'm an idiot. I had no idea.
Now you know Cindy's the idiot, and I just didn't make it really clear that the statute in the section addresses both evictions and criminal history. And I did combine those. But you did ask about the crimes that aren't considered at all. That can be considered. It's a double negative. We put in the statute what you can consider, and everything else that's not there, you can't consider. And the crimes that we said you can consider are convictions, not just being charged with something, but an actual conviction. And if you're charged with something and then you are not guilty, that's off there, too. It's just if you were convicted of a drug-related crime, a person crime, or a rape, sex offense, or financial fraud. Those are the only things that you can consider. So, yeah, thanks. I'm sorry you probably were sitting there running through your computer, reading all your statute. I just wasted a lot of your time, but I'm sorry I melded those in the beginning of the conversation.
No worries. Yeah, I mean, I guess I know you've got to go, but something that I like to look on is, you know, I know that these crimes give a lot of people pause, but I think we as a committee should look into what we can do. I mean, this is a very broad swath of crimes and if there is any way to sort of add a time limit to them, I don't know how politically feasible that is, but that's just something that I think is at least looking into, you know.
We discussed this at length at Landlord-Tenant Coalition Law, and if I can or Deborah can, get those notes together and kind of see what that background was. I give those to the senator. Before I leave, I would like to say one thing. If you guys lean towards a mitigation fund that helps with this and helps landlords to maybe recover some of the money if there is a problem, or in addition, I would like it if you really looked at it and said, okay, what can we do to maybe help use that money to help someone in the reentry program to pay for their deposit. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I would love it if you looked at the program, any kind of mitigation fund, and said, how can we help people in general if they had a bad month? I mean, people should not be losing their homes because they had, you know, a bad month and can't catch up. So if you ever look at a mitigation fund again, I know Section 8 had to be really specific, but if you ever look at a mitigation fund again, I hope that you'll extend it to a lot of people who have a lot of issues that need help that end up falling into a bad cycle for housing because of one thing. And thank you. Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry I have to leave.
Thank you.
Let's call Ryan. Question.
Jeremy, this is Deborah.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi. So I kind of wanted to weigh in on that. On your, do you think we could ever look at the timing or have that? I don't know necessarily that we would be looking at it a blanket timing. Lower it to X amount for everybody. But I will say to you that the HUD new guidelines specifically say, because of the criminal justice system and the fact that a disproportionate amount of people of color are in the correctional system, that we must have some kind of individual analysis. Now, this is all so new because it was in April, and so people don't quite know what that means yet, but I will tell you that I know that it means that, some of those folks in that category are going to have to be, we're going to have a process where they have an opportunity to, whether it's to appeal or where management companies and owners and landlords are going to have a way to look at them and see, were they, based on like what this correction person told us in Templeton, have they followed all these, great things while they were incarcerated? Have they done this, and this? I mean, like I said, I don't know what it's gonna look like, but I know that we're not gonna be able to do this blanket, anybody with this crime, this amount of years, is automatically denied. That will change.
Well, that is great to hear.
And I hope, for me, I'm hoping as part of this task force, as well as several others that I'm on, that it can help inform how landlords do that and do it in a responsible, consistent way that helps people with the barriers, but also doesn't get us, the concern right now is that we're going to get in fair housing trouble someplace else because, we don't have a consistent policy. And then right now, I think the jury is out on how does this impact liability for the landlord? If somebody is, comes into a unit and does a repeat crime, where's the liability for the landlord in that? And I think, earlier in the conversation when we were talking about the university system and somebody said, whether you check the box or don't check the box, that's probably not going to, remove a liability issue. So, maybe that's where we'll end up on the housing side as well.
Great. Thank you, Deb.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Paul, you had that here. Part two.
Right. So, thank you, Chair. Ryan, I have some questions about how all of the housing authorities operate in using criminal history. So, day before yesterday, Mike Schmidt, the director of the Criminal Justice Commission, someone from Linn County's Housing Authority, and I went and met with folks from Linn County to talk about their criminal history question that they're considering using or implementing. So HUD requires that you not use that you not allow people with sex offense convictions and manufacturing methamphetamine convictions in public housing. But aside from those two convictions, housing authorities have quite a bit of discretion in who they allow in. Interestingly, there was a piece in the New York Times day before yesterday about this issue, and it cited New Orleans Housing Authority. And what in New Orleans happened to have one of the highest percentages of its population going to prison in the country. And at the same time, they had effectively barred anybody with a criminal history from entering public housing. So they took a look at what they were doing, and they basically turned their policies upside down. And now they have one of the most progressive policies of allowing people with criminal histories, and they set up a panel to review people with criminal histories, and they have a fairly liberal approach to doing that. But it seems to me that each housing authority does it differently, and some are more liberal than others. And I just would like you to speak to whether this is an issue, whether other housing authorities are starting to take this on around the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, in Oregon, I believe, 20 housing authorities. And the way that housing authorities are structured, each of them is an independent organization. Their structure is created in state statute. Their funding comes from the federal government directly to the housing authority. Their board must be comprised of at least one resident and then mostly local folks. And in some places, it's local electeds and community members. There's a little bit of difference, but they each have their own board. And then each housing authority creates its own administrative plan. And that administrative plan is approved by the local board, and it includes a number of things, but one of those things that it includes is what are our criteria, not only for public housing, but also for the voucher program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, or Section 8. And so you're right, there are different policies between one housing authority to another. Those same two exemptions required by HUD for public housing, my understanding is they also apply for the voucher program.
Can I just tag on to that really quick? Because we went through a long process. I serve on the board of our housing authority. And
Salem or, oh, you're up
Marion, Marion County. Yeah. And this was maybe 10 years ago when I started working on reentry, pulled some groups together. And so there's a lot of this that goes on with it. So the housing authority will say the federal government let us, all right? And then but then other people in the community will say, well, it's the housing authority. And if you don't see the plan all the time, frankly, the prejudices or whatever you want to call them, the perspectives of the staff that are putting those plans together can kind of slip it by the board. And so we had to do a lot of digging and trying to understand what it was that we were actually approving and get our housing authority directors and staff in meetings with people that were involved with reentry to help them understand what was going on. And so I think education with board members on those housing authorities is a huge need because you just can't assume that they understand. And at the City of Salem, I think they've had the same type of thing where they've layered on requirements and they don't even realize that it's their requirements.
Yeah, and some of those requirements are artifacts of history that are
just carry forward. Right, yeah, exactly.
But, yeah. Now, in addition to the HUD guidance that Deborah and I have spoken to that applies to all landlords, there's another one that specifically applies to housing authorities. And one of the pieces of that is pushing on housing authorities to go back and look at their administrative plans, make sure that arrests are not being considered in the application process, and reminding them that other things are not required. So it stops short of saying that you can't screen against A, B, or C, but it very clearly says you are not required to screen against A, B, or C. And so I think that you're right, that at a local level, those discussions need to happen. And, you know, one of the other things that we're talking about in this training, because a portion of the training is for housing authorities, is to look at the demographics of your community, not just the overall demographics of your community, but the demographics of the people who are income eligible for your programs, because sometimes those demographics look different than the community at large's demographics. And how are your programs matching that demographic? And are there policies not just about admissions, but then also about maintaining housing that could be impacting how those ratios are stacking up?
And if I could just add one more thing to our exploration on that. So when we were talking to a particular staff person, not in our housing authority, but another one, if you had a drug-related crime, you would automatically be rejected. But there was a letter that you would get that would say that you could appeal. And so if you were to appeal, the federal regulation says you have to have been involved in treatment, but it doesn't say how long, if you have to complete. It's completely at the discretion of the local housing authority to say that, you know, you've had enough and this is okay, we can let you in. And the person that we were talking to, they said, you know, we said, well, what happens when they, you know, first of all, a lot of people wouldn't appeal, right? And he said, actually, 60% of the people that got those letters never did appeal. So he said, so we don't have to worry about them. So it really kind of solved their problem about whether or not they wanted to let those folks into their housing, because they knew that the vast majority of them, they would just deny, the person would never appeal, and then it was not their problem anymore. So that's where I'm saying that that's a layered on regulation that we could look at to help improve that.
By the way, I tried to get your housing authority director to be here in my place. She's not in town right now. Otherwise, able to have her expertise instead of mine.
And she's not the one I'm talking about. She's
of course, yeah.
Great. Well, this has been helpful to me, although I'm not sure where we go with all this information. But, you know, if there's anything legislative that we should be looking at, you know, we heard talk about putting more money into the mitigation fund. I don't know what else.
I also heard about some of the crimes and the five-year limit is really...
Perhaps go back to Senate Bill 91 and do some work on that. Mm-hmm.
One thing that I would throw out, and Janet and I have spent a bit of time talking about this, and so we've been successful in partnering with our housing authority in Lane County to go after 9% tax credits that are allocated by Oregon Housing Community Services for low-income housing. And it's been a struggle to figure out how to do this in other parts of the state. Part of it has to do with scales of economy and size. In order for these projects to pencil out, you need to have about 50 units. And you can't do that in smaller jurisdictions. And you have to have someone like a sponsors or provider that can partner with the housing authority. But it's a great development tool. And right now, in OHCS's current strategic plan, this is a population that they've identified it as high needs and a group that they want to serve. So I would love for us to think about ways that we can make this process a little easier. And I don't know if you have any ideas, but I know Marion County's been working on this for a while.
The low-income housing tax credit, because we were doing transitional housing, and it didn't.
It didn't fly.
They actually separated that out.
So. Uh-huh.
So we're going to use Section 32 money if HUD says okay.
So I guess I just want to throw this out. There isn't enough housing. I get 50 letters a week from people in prison in this state every week, and one out of four is someone from another county that wants to come to Lane County because there's housing there in the county they're returning to. They're going to be homeless when they're released, and that's a real problem.
I think the last several housing cycles for those 9% credits that he's speaking about, there were three applications for every one that there were funds for.
They're highly competitive, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's a huge pipeline. There's just not adequate resources. I definitely would encourage this mitigation fund as an immediate first step legislatively. Cindy talked about, is there something we could do for month to month? There is something in place called the Emergency Housing Account. And last session, there was a one-time allocation of an additional $10 million toward that account. Another thing the legislature could do would be to roll that up and make that an ongoing allocation, because that is for the emergency rental assistance that can prevent somebody from becoming homeless. And then there's one thing that legislature has already done, which we're just now beginning to explore, which is expanded the eligible uses for individual development accounts. And this is a matched savings program for people who are income eligible. And one of the expanded areas is somebody can save for first and last month's rent and a deposit if it's connected to a state priority. And I would certainly say that this is a state policy priority. And so figuring out ways that we can integrate that IDA program at the community level with other work that's going on could be a way to help folks. You know, if I am part of that program and I'm able to save $100, then it typically would be matched so that I would have $400.
Yeah, that would be amazing. We should definitely try to pursue that.
Yeah, no, the IDA program has a lot of potential to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's thank you. Thank you very much, Ryan. Let's move to our last item, and that is we'll start on the subject of fines. And I say start because this is a subject that we knew was going to be on our work plan that I'm sure we're going to be talking about over several meetings. But we wanted to start off with DMV, and you know, because many of the fines that are problematic to people do come from traffic offenses, and there have been efforts to deal with that, but it remains a barrier. So.
Turn it over to me.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Dembrough, members of the task force, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the Oregon DMV administrator, and I wasn't exactly sure what you were looking for from me, so I've got a number of things in the materials that were presented to you a few hours before the meeting, so I know you didn't have much time to really take a look at what was there. But I wanted to take the opportunity to kind of quickly describe the processes we go through for issuance of a driver's license or a state-issued ID card, because that seems to be the primary focus of the committee like this, is that photo ID is so important for someone upon a reentry for housing, employment, all those types of things that we're discussing here. So it's an enabler in that sense, and recognized by our agency as such. So I wanted to take just a few minutes to talk about some of those requirements, some of the history that we've had with the Department of Corrections and agreements that we have in place that I think are working quite well to help offenders better prepare for release prior to release by having an ID card or even a driver's license that they have in their possession when they leave. So if you have the materials, I'll just kind of quickly walk through this. There are, as you might imagine, a number of state laws that determine how or whether we can issue a driver's license or an ID card to someone. And those fall into categories of the documentation the person would have to present, their driving history, passing of tests, a photograph, providing fees. For an ID card, it's really documentation of photo and fees. You don't have that driving history to deal with. Around documentation, there's a number of things that we're looking for there. The person must be able to prove that they're in this country legally. So that can be a U.S. citizen with a U.S. birth certificate or a U.S. passport. It could be someone legally here through immigration documentation. They provide that to us. And we do verification of the immigration documents through a system called SAVE, Systematic Alien Verification and Enforcement System, with the Department of Homeland Security. So we do an electronic verification of that document. We've had legal presence in Oregon since about 2008, and the legislature approved that. We also look for a valid Social Security number from the individual, and we do a check against the Social Security Administration's database of both the number and the name for a match. So that's another identity type check that we do. The person also must prove identity and their date of birth to us. And that might be on the documents I just mentioned to you, or it could be something else. But typically it's a passport, birth certificate, or immigration document. And then residency. you must be an Oregon resident to obtain Oregon driving privileges or an Oregon ID card. So some way of documenting where you live, or in this case, where you plan to live upon release. So those are the basic things we're looking at as far as documents go. We also take a look at the person's driving history. If they're applying for a driver license or a renewal or a replacement of a driver license, we're looking to see if they have a suspension or a revocation in Oregon or maybe even in another state. There's a separate system that we confer with, a problem driver pointer system that all states are using, to check that, to see if the person maybe have the terrible driving record in Washington, they're coming to Oregon to try to get a driving privileges, and we will reject them if they have active suspensions on the record in that system.
This is the area that I'm the most interested in. So, and I'm looking at your chart here that you have in the packet.
Yes.
And so like 8,200, it's failure to pay child support and they're suspended. So this is for any reason that they might be suspended, right? Not just driving reasons?
Yes.
So then the question that I have is, it's a judge that determines those types of suspensions, right? It's not DMV. So DMV can't lift a suspension. It's the judge that has to do it in whatever court setting, municipal court, circuit court. Is that true?
What you have here is a mixture. Most of these are court-ordered, so a judge is making that determination. You have some things here, failure to provide insurance or provide an accident report. If you're involved in a crash, there's a requirement that you provide information to us about that crash. If you don't, we determine that you did not, we can suspend your driving privileges. So there's a kind of a combination of some administrative things that our agency does, and most of these are really court-ordered things.
Right. So I guess for me, and I'll just say it, you're looking for legislative types of things, and I don't know if legislation does it, but it seems like when we did the Justice Reinvestment 3194, there's been kind of a whole new perspective in collaboration between courts and DA about kind of how we're handling some of these things. And probably the worst thing you can do to someone if you want them to get a job and be gainfully employed and be a good citizen is to pull their driver's license and now they can't, you know, they're riding a bike or they're taking public transportation, which in Salem only operates 5 days a week. And so if we can take a look more carefully at some of these things, and I don't know how we engage the courts because they're the ones, the judges are the ones that impose these types of things, but to rethink when are we applying this and are there other sanctions or carrots and sticks, I guess, that you can use other than the suspension of the driver's license. So
yeah, I agree. And the fact that failure to pay child support is the top one on there, that to me seems to be the most egregious of them all, because it takes away a person's ability
to
work and pay child support. You know, it's counterintuitive.
And so is the rationale that this is the only hammer that we have as a state to this happen?
I think this is something that's happened around the country, and it's been one of those policies that's been enacted, and there hasn't been a lot of thought that's been put into.
The example that you've selected, though, that failure to pay child support is actually a federal requirement.
Really?
And state law mimics that, but it is something that's required.
The Not federal many government on this requires list. You to suspend their license if they don't pay child support?
Yeah. It's identified as the sanction or one of the sanctions to be applied.
And Mr. Chair,
really?
If I could add to those remarks, these are this state's DMV looking at a conviction in another state for driving under suspension if it's administrative or traffic related. It's not a pending case. It's a conviction.
Yes.
Adjudicated.
The license, the privilege to drive. So it's not as if someone, it's not a floating a charge, an arrest for that. It's actually something that's
It's a conviction that's showing
state.
Up. We've been notified through the courts that the conviction has taken place. Or it's a conviction in another state that state is adding to the problem driver pointer system that I mentioned before. If you look it's a very small print here. We've got some asterisks after some of these, and the asterisk goes to right under attachment one on the document. It says some of these may contain a suspension code that is federally mandated. So beyond the state statutes, mm-hmm. we may have some federal law to look at as well. If you want to,
we could probably work on that with our federal delegation too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I just think that there's. Just given what we're dealing with justice in this country and locally, and kind of rethinking what makes sense for different things, this I just know working with a few people that I've worked with to try to contact the courts to say, so how do we take care of some of these things mm-hmm. so that this person can drive? There's just a layer of fees, fines, and it's just it'll never happen for that person, no matter how good they are, no matter how hard they work, and I just We need to try to figure out how to solve that.
There's an association of motor vehicle, or DMV, agencies across the country and also Canadian provinces, and this is one of the things they've studied, and their recommendation coming out of that study was that states eliminate non-driving-related suspensions. And a few states have moved forward. Washington actually has made some real progress in that area, of eliminating extra suspensions, as not relying on that as the sanction of choice to get people to do something or to pay something or whatever. It also has law enforcement implications. There's a workload associated with, and the courts as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. There, further down on that in that chart is one that is disturbing to me, and it's the failure to appear. Mm-hmm. The numbers there are rather extraordinary, but the numbers are also don't show up the kind of psychological impact if you know you have a bench warrant out for you because of failure to appear. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with enough people. And worked with the program. I did a little bit, but very little. Talking that was attempting to deal with some of those failure to appear situations, and basically, the way that it's been put to me by several people who were involved is that they were constantly looking over their shoulder because they were sure that they had to take back roads or they avoided any possible connection, and they also didn't tell family where they worked because they didn't want to have someone come in and say, we want to get to this particular person, mm-hmm. When they were able to erase that aspect, mm-hmm. of their problems, they were much more interested in what was going on, and that's a different. All of these things are things that we need to be working on.
Yeah. So what is failure to comply exactly?
What is that?
Some kind of a court order. Most likely it's going to be a payment, a penalty of some kind that the individual, a citation that they failed to pay.
I see.
And those are
the largest numbers.
Those are the biggest numbers. And a good portion of these, the underlying citation is driving related.
Right.
Okay? Just so you know, we're not recommending that all failure to comply or all failure to appear suspensions may be done away with. I think you have to really look at the underlying conviction or citation that led to this. They weren't convicted for the speeding ticket. They were convicted because they didn't show up or they didn't pay the ticket.
Yeah.
That's the type of suspension that's showing up in our records.
And is that something that Washington has... Have they unpacked that failure?
They have.
Apply?
Yes, they have.
I'd like to see what
that's possible to unpack.
It is possible.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you have to work with the courts, got to work with the judges,
exactly.
And be clear about what is and what is not going to be a suspension.
But I would just say there's no better time to take a look at this, because at least in our experience, the courts are very open to looking at new ways of doing things right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at LEAD, this law enforcement assisted diversion with mental illness and approaching mental illness differently. And so it's just a time of change, and I think there's opportunity to connect in that way.
And these are 2013 numbers. So we could get you more current information if you'd like. This is a little bit dated, what we're working with here, but some we had handy we could present to you. Okay.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting, but that was a big concern of mine.
But that is an important aspect of the driver license, a replacement or a renewal transaction. We do look at that driving history, not criminal history per se, but the driving-related history. So I pretty much covered that next part. I think it's interesting to note that at any one time, there's about 660,000 drivers with suspended licenses in Oregon. And I say drivers because they probably are driving. Their driving privileges have been suspended. In total, about 2.6 million active suspensions, about a 1-to-4 ratio there.
Wow.
So you don't just get one suspension necessarily. And some get multiple suspensions because they're driving while suspended. They get another one on top of that. So it does become a spiral there. Testing, there are three different types of tests that we do. We do a knowledge test, a skills test, operate the vehicle, and a vision test. If first-time applicants have to pass the vision test, and if you're over 50 and you come in to renew, you have to take the vision test. Also a photograph. Oregon's licenses and ID cards are good for 8 years, unless it's a limited term issuance for like an immigrant who has a specific date that their legal presence ends. But most of our cards are issued for 8 years. We take a photo when you come back in to renew that card. There are some exceptions to that. With military stationed overseas, we can use the photo that's on file for those individuals to renew and get another 8 years. And then a process we have also for the correctional system. So, and then there's fees. They range for an ID card to a driver's license from $26.50 to $60. And I can get you more specifics if you want that type of information as far as what each one is. We're charging people. A knowledge test is $5. A skills test, the drive test, is $9. The reinstatement fee. If someone's license has been suspended, and in order to reinstate their driving privileges, they pay a $75 fee. That's a deterrent for some people, many people, to pay that. Just quickly, some of the things that we are doing with the Department of Corrections, and like I said, it's a fairly long history we've had, partnership we've had with them. We entered into an interagency agreement in November of 2009 to do a study of the various options to help offenders to leave the institutions with a state-issued photo ID. We have a separate interagency agreement that allows, and we entered into this at the end of 2012, and we've extended it a couple of times. The current one expires, I think, in 2017. It allows us to, upon presenting the documents that we require, that birth certificate, Social Security card, the fees, all those types of things, submit that to us. And if we have a photo on file of that individual, so a previous issuance, that's at least, it's no more than 9 years and 2 months. I think it's system-wise why we ended up with that unusual time frame. But it's, if there's a photo that was taken at least within 9 years and 2 months, we will use that photo to issue a new card to that individual. And that's a combination of maybe an original ID card, because they've never been issued an ID card before. They've given up their driving privileges, we'll issue an ID card. Could be a replacement card, because they've lost it, or maybe it was confiscated when they were admitted to the institution. That used to be a common practice in our state prisons. That was automatically, they shredded the driver's license when the person came in. Yeah. I think they've stopped that practice, but yeah. It was an interesting finding that we had a few years ago.
Max Williams used to talk about that.
Yeah, he did, actually. And we're focusing really on individuals who anticipate release within 90 days. So it really is, it's imminent. They're close to release, and so we're trying to get them that card. There are situations where the person does not have an address they've identified for release, and so we will use the Office for the Parole and Probation Office as a temporary interim address with the expectation that they once they find housing or a place that they're living, that they will notify us and correct that our record so it has a more current address for them. We've got May of this last month. We received 279 of these applications from the Department of Corrections. We were able to provide 175 individuals with credentials of that. That's a pretty high percentage. Since we started this, we've issued over 3,000 individuals an ID card or a driver's license through this process. I think it's pretty good. The other option that we, or other channel that we have in place, is that in Madras and at our North Salem office, the institutions are transporting up to 10 offenders to those locations per month, and we are issuing ID cards to those individuals. And those are predominantly people who have never been issued before. They don't really qualify for this other process. They need to present and have a new photo taken, those individuals. We've done approximately 1,300 of those since 2009 when we started doing it. So we're continuing at those two locations. We're in very early stages of a conversation with the Federal Bureau of Prisons for something similar for those who anticipate reentry within Oregon. Early stages. We're just explaining the process we have with the Department of Corrections and the steps that they would have to follow, birth certificates, Social Security cards, all those types of things. There's a lot of support that goes into preparing the individual. Also, on a daily basis, we get requests from offenders. They'll mail letters to us. You know, what do I need to do? I know I have some suspensions, some convictions that may prevent me from reinstating my driving privileges. What do I need to do? And which courts, because they don't remember, which courts, which judges do I need to contact? And so we provide that information to them. We transmit that to them and then point them in the direction of the places they need to go to take care of the problems that they have, to clear up their records so we can issue to them, hopefully, when they are released. So that's a service we also provide. So just the bottom line is I think our agency has worked really well with the Department of Corrections. So with the state institutions, we've done a pretty good job of helping offenders leave prison with state-issued photo ID, or at least be a little better prepared when they do leave so that they can go to a DMV office and be successful with an issuance. So there are some statistics here. You looked at that. I think one of the sheets didn't have much of a header on it, but one of the sheets is the valid with previous photo process that we do, and that we started that in January of 2013. So what was that, about 40 months worth of experience? And we've issued about 3,166 as of February. So I think it's over 3,200 at this point. You've got the breakout here of how many original IDs or renewal, replacement, those types of things. You can see the mix that's happening there. Most of these are actually the original IDs. That 864, a replacement ID is the most, 1,429. We break it out by institution. We also break it out by the county they're returning to. So you can see it covers pretty much everybody. The other statistics there, I think that's the one that's missing the header. That's DMV IDs, the trips to the two offices. And this is from 2009 through February of 2016. That number at the top, 1,228, that's as of February. That's how many we'd issued since we started the program. And it's got a breakout here. The hash marks you've got where the costs weren't showing, the total costs, $52,204, if you wanted to know that. And the replacements were $13,351, and the original cards were $31,239, just because the numbers didn't show up in the Excel spreadsheet for some reason. Principal reasons that we didn't issue, the inmate is eligible to receive a driver license upon release, and they just prefer to do that. They may owe some fines, some problems with their identity. Maybe they've transferred to a non-participating facility. They were at a facility that was going to go to those two locations, but now they're not. So they do not participate. There was a study done, I believe it was around 2010, 2011, where we evaluated several different options from what other states have done, from a mobile unit that goes around the state, like a bookmobile, bloodmobile kind of a thing, or there's a DMV mobile. You go to local communities, but you could also go to correctional facilities, hook up your systems and networks and electrical and everything else. What we found is most of the states that had those systems in place had gone after FEMA money for tornadoes and hurricanes and kind of that emergency response to help individuals if there was a natural disaster of some kind, to be ready to come in and issue driver's licenses or ID cards or even to verify someone's identity through the DMVs. We do not have that here in Oregon. The study determines it is the most expensive of the options that was studied, and there is risk associated with having the equipment that we're working with and the sensitive inventory that we're responsible for, cards and paper and things like that that are we keep pretty close to the vest, have that driving around the state a little more prone to potential nefarious acts. So,
well, at least now you take credit cards.
That's right. That's something we can tout in most offices. It's coming to a community near you. Salem's all covered.
Great.
So, Commissioner Campbell,
I've got a question.
Yeah. Tom, I have a question. So a few years ago, I worked on legislation with Amy that had to do with offenders who were released and then entered a pre-apprenticeship program that gave them an opportunity through a partnership between DMV and the courts and the community college or whoever was the sponsor of the pre-apprenticeship program to get them a temporary or a provisional license for the time that they were in the program. And it was, you know, in part, it was a kind of carrot, you know, to mm-hmm. keep them engaged in the program. And these were people who had outstanding fines that were keeping them from getting their license back. And that then they would be able to start paying off their fines once they actually found employment after completing the program. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, and Amy, maybe this is a question for you. I haven't really followed up to see how well it's working, to see if it's actually being used. And, you know, in the course of our discussions here, Jen Netherwood, who's she's involved in a program that's being restored at Coffee Creek, which is a pre-apprenticeship program within the institution. And that, so presumably then when the individual is released, they could be ready to actually be apprentices. And so, you know, the legislation that we passed just spoke to pre-apprenticeship, but we're thinking we may have to come back and expand that to apprenticeship. I don't have a sense yet if the program is actually working. I haven't really followed up on it.
Yeah, Chair Denbrough, I recall the bill very well. I think the thing is we don't know DMV, and there's no way DMV can know, because what happens under that bill is that the person petitions the court to be granted kind of a release from the, I think it's typically a failure to comply kind of suspension, the court fines and fees type of suspension. So the court allows that suspension to be lifted, and they, I mean, thousands of these come into DMV every day in terms of the court saying to the DMV, you may lift that suspension. So the suspension's just lifted in the record, and then when the person comes in and applies for the reinstatement or the hardship permit, then that's granted. So there's no way for DMV to know. That would need to be, I think, probably like a survey through the courts to figure that out.
Okay. And then presumably if the individual was not keeping her his end of the bargain, the suspension would just be restored then by the court.
Yeah, there was a provision in the bill about staying in the apprenticeship program, beginning to start to make payments on those court fines. I don't think they were forgiven. So, yeah, there were a bunch of criteria to maintain that.
Okay. Well, we'll want to look at that because, you know, we may want to expand it to include apprentices.
A lot of people that enter into apprenticeship programs don't necessarily come from pre-apprenticeship programs, so expanding that is just going to open up that avenue for a larger number of men and women coming out of prison.
Yes, Paul.
So first, Tom, thanks for all your good work. I mean, as a charter member of the Governor's Reentry Council, I know that you've been working on this for a number of years. Couple of questions. One, I know that you were kind of limited with the locations on the pilot project, so correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it Madras and one of the Salem institutions?
North Salem and Madras, yes.
So have you guys looked, so that one excludes the women in Coffee Creek from being able to participate. Have you looked at trying to expand to other institutions? That's my first question. And secondly, you know, when I look at these numbers, over 3,000 people for a total cost of $127,000, from a fiscal standpoint, that isn't a lot of money given the number of people that we are removing a very significant barrier for. So I guess I would love for this body to think about how can we think about a little bit of money goes a long ways towards providing someone ID when $36 may be the only thing that stands between them and an Oregon identification card that can help them get access to myriad things. So, two things there.
Well, and to the last one, that the numbers you're seeing there are the actual fees paid to us. So the value of the issuance, it's not necessarily the cost that went into making it happen.
Right.
Right.
You know, corrections might need another staff person if they were to double their capacity.
Yeah, right.
Likewise for us. We might have to have some considerations there, too. But
right.
Just so you're clear on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I get that. That's not necessarily the cheapest way. But even once people are out of prison, I mean, there are ways that community corrections could subsidize if they had the resources, and then it wouldn't take the DOC and DMV staff time.
Right. Right. And to your first question, we have had some conversations with Department of Corrections and specific to Coffee Creek, too.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an office in Wilsonville, so it's a little further transport, Woodburn, Sherwood. It's a little further they'd have to go to get to the DMV office.
Got it.
We're not against it,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's more the cost for them and the logistics for them. And we didn't do this, of course, to exclude the females from
right.
not participating. It's more where it happens to be located and where our offices are today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not as feasible. Another one we looked at, I think, was Klamath Falls, Lakeview, mm-hmm. in that area. For us, it's a one-person office.
Yeah.
It's an outpost,
mm-hmm.
as much as anything. Mm-hmm. So we're a bit limited in what we can do as far as extended hours, because these are done before the general public comes in. We schedule this before the general public, an hour before. It's usually a manager or a lead worker that handles those transactions. And they're some of the cleanest transactions we've got, because these are pristine documents they're bringing in.
Mm-hmm.
Certified birth certificates and, you know, Social Security cards just issued mm-hmm. by the federal government. You know, these are pretty clean. And papers all filled out ahead of time, and they got the check made out, and all that works very, very smoothly.
Thank you.
Okay, but thank you very much.
You bet. If you need any copies of things or for your report, let me know.
No, I'm sure after just what I've learned in this last half hour, we have some work to do here, and perhaps it's some fruitful work.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. look forward to working with you on it.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So the last item on the agenda is further discussion, but really we've run out of time. So I think actually we do have a lot to discuss I have a lot to think about based on what we heard on every one of the topics tonight and today. And I look forward to thinking some more about it, but I'd ask you all to do the same. And any thoughts that you have that you might want to share with me, I'd be happy to hear. As we, we're starting to get to the point where, we really need to move forward and start thinking about specific legislation. And that may involve maybe breaking up into groups of two or three that have a particular interest in a particular topic. Anyway, just let me know your thoughts, okay? And that includes, I guess it doesn't include you, Jeremy. Yes, I'll take your thoughts for as long as you're willing to give them.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it.
And Deborah, again, welcome to the group. And look forward to our ongoing work. And with that, everyone, we are adjourned. With that, everyone, we are adjourned.